And yes, as Jim Duff said, Montreal is filled with liberals, supposedly almost 5,000 of them. Except you keep running into people who say, who cares? And you know, the sad thing about who cares as far as liberalism, smaller liberalism goes, is that smaller liberalism was about caring. It was the great liberating philosophy for the rising middle classes, the small businessmen, the upwardly mobile working classes. It was that philosophy that was going to free people from the big C conservatism of the elites and the statocratic engineering of the socialists. It was that philosophy that said that we will do in common what we all need done and no more, and allow for the maximum expansion of the individual possibility. That was the promise of liberalism. But something happened, as Joseph Heller called one of his novels. Liberalism in Canada ceased to be small L liberalism, started to be big L liberalism, big L interests, vested interests. And this wasn't just the past 20 years. This goes back to the Mackenzie King era. For a small, short time under Trudeau, though many policies were bad, the individual became important over any collective or over the state itself. But for the past 20 years, the Liberal Party has become the party of vested interest, the party of Bay Street, not of Main Street, a party so removed from the roots of what liberalism was that it doesn't know a policy from a polecat. And yeah, there are a lot of people mad at both sides of the party. They're mad at the Chrétien side that was involved with ad scam, and they're mad at the Martin side who were making tax laws for the rich and deflecting their premeditated maneuvering of the public purse with spending public money to attack their enemies within the party. But the broad question is, what possible reason do you have to vote for the Liberal Party? What's the alternative they offer? In 1911... the Asquith government was in power in England, and it was the first government, without a depression, to bring in social welfare, to bring in unemployment insurance. Not because of any desperate need, not because it was a depression and thousands of people camped outside the White House, as it happened in the 1930s, but because it was the right and decent thing to do. And a minister of social welfare of that government said the following: to raise people up from poverty, to reconcile private interests with public rights, to attack monopoly, to reward enterprise, but not with untrammeled privilege and preference, to exalt the individual over ruler or regulation, and to expand freedom at home and abroad. This is our liberalism. This is the signature of our society. That great radical was no less a man than Winston Leonard Spencer Churchill, who at that time was serving as Minister of Social Welfare in the Asquith government. And that was what liberalism was. That's where it stopped, doing the big things. Government was taking the role of education, of persuasion, not of coercion, not of compulsion, and certainly not of writing checks to every group that squealed to get votes and to cover up what money was going to corporate interests that now amounts to a third of the federal budget. Today, the Liberal Party is known for three simple things. If it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. And if it stops moving, subsidize it. And there is the problem. And it's my pleasure to have with me tonight to talk about this problem for the next little while, John Ibbotson, columnist for the Globe and Mail, Canada's national newspaper. And I quoted John in an article I recently wrote. John, I'm going to throw the words back at you. But he put it very succinctly today, a party that needs to end its identity crisis. The fact is that the only thing that is important is that the Liberals have yet to offer anyone a compelling reason to vote for them. John Ibbotson, welcome.
Good evening, Beryl.
Welcome to Montreal. How are you enjoying yourself?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's a political convention. I'm a political columnist. It doesn't get better than that.
Okay, now, John, Jim Duff said before 7 o'clock that Liberals go out and get laid, Tories go out and get drunk, and the NDP goes out for dinner and talks. I said the NDP actually goes out for dinner only after they hug trees, but I figure we're seeing all three at this convention.
Well, I really can't talk about what's been going on in the hotel rooms. My remit doesn't go that far. And also, although we're supposed to have upwards of 5,000 to 6,000 delegates, so far I don't think we have that much more than 2,000.
Well, it's pretty pricey to come in. Nobody's subsidizing it.
it's pricey, and the young liberals, the students, are all finishing their end of term essays and stuff. So I don't expect to see the full crowd here until later in the week. But yeah, the all the trappings are here. In fact, just literally a couple of minutes before we came on, competing Ignatieff and Dion camps were trying to outshout each other in the hallway. We're all getting ready right now for Howard Dean's speech, the American political who's coming up to talk to the party. So in that way, it is a liberal convention as to what they're doing. As I say, outside that, I'm really not prepared to speak.
John, we're just going to take a short break here because they're gesticulating wildly to pay some bills, and I'm going to quote some words back at you, and I'm going to point and counterpoint that to your column today. We'll be right back with John Ibbotson of the Globe and Mail. This half hour, we're talking about does liberal party leadership mean anything to you? And we will want to hear from you. If you're on a cell phone, *940 for Rogers users, #940 for Bell users, does the party mean anything anymore? And we've got one of the best minds in the country with us, John Ibbotson of the Globe and Mail. John, to get back to what I wanted to do, point and counterpoint. Some time ago, you wrote in a column that the new Conservative government may be possibly, quote, the most principled in recent Canadian history. Whether you agree with the principles or not, you know what you're getting. And today you wrote, the Liberals have to offer a reason to vote for them. They have an identity crisis. Now, the Conservatives have made certain virages, but basically what was said, they're doing. They've put forward the image and the words of a government that wants to represent Main Street, not Bay Street, that wants to roll back government, that's set on a new vision in foreign policy. Has the Conservative Party become the new face of industrial liberalism? And if they have, how do you unflank that?
Well, that's a huge question, but that's typical from you, isn't it?
it's not huge. Let me narrow it down, okay? How do you get around the fact that one party represents what the other party's name meant, and the other party, the Liberal Party, has to be concerned with nothing more than what can I give to the group screaming the loudest? Which is
something. Because names don't mean that much anymore. You're absolutely right. If you go back to a textbook definition of liberalism and a textbook definition of conservatism, neither party anymore represents what those classical 19th century definitions originally meant to say. What matters is, and I stand by it, the conservatives have a platform, they have an agenda, they have a set of values, and they're sticking to it. Do those values represent the majority of the country? Maybe not. But people keep saying the conservatives are playing to their base, whether for principle or for politics. They are certainly sticking to those principles.
And certainly that's part of leadership. Even if you're not the majority view, you lead to what you believe is right. You don't pander
right.
to the lowest common denominator.
And the liberal principle was to govern. Because that's what liberals do. They, for most of the 20th century, they just governed, and you take issues as they come. They are a party of ultimate pragmatism. And I had said way back in April, when Frank McKenna and John Manley said they weren't going to run for leadership and people were saying, oh, the big guns aren't running, I said it's a good thing the big guns aren't running, because the liberals need to ask themselves not just who should lead them, who can beat Stephen Harper in an election. The liberals need to ask themselves who they are, what they stand for, and why are they steadily diminishing to a few urban rumps across the country. Big rumps, yes, Toronto, Montreal, Vancouver, but rumps none the same. I think they are in danger, as I've said, of following the fate of the Liberal Party of Great Britain, which was eventually extinguished.
Yeah. Now,
and nothing happened. I would contend, we've had a 9-month leadership race, with the exception of Michael Ignatieff, who, again, love him or hate him, has taken some pretty strong stands and caused a fair bit of controversy. The other candidates, and Stephanie
controversy Young, is not a bad thing, except he flip-flopped all over the place, and he, of course, raised this nation issue again. But okay, that's what he wanted to raise, but there were so many flip-flops back and forth. And this is what I'm sorry, you anticipated a question. I didn't let you finish your comment.
Well, I was just saying that there's Ignatieff on minorities. He was doing it again today, condemning the conservatives for voting against the Declaration on Aboriginal Rights at the UN, which is actually a very controversial thing for him to have done. Stéphane Dion is all about the environment. But these are single-issue things.
Right.
These are not comprehensive philosophies, visions for a party.
They're not comprehensive.
That they had 9 months to work on. And Bob Rae and Gerard Kennedy are running exclusively on the platform, I can beat Stephen Harper. I don't know exactly how I'm going to beat Stephen Harper, but trust me, I've got the face, I've got the looks, I've got the people, I've got the organization that can beat Stephen Harper. That's not a reason to vote for someone, I would contend. Not a reason for a party to exist.
And you anticipated my question to you, which was that we have the four leading candidates, and as you said, Dion is running on environment, although, of course, he was the champion of one Canada. You don't hear him talk about that. Environment is an important issue for a government, like defense, like anything else, but it's not a vision. Gerard Kennedy came out against the One Nation thing, but Gerard Kennedy was as Minister of Education in Ontario, and him and his buddy Jim Watson, the Minister of Health Promotion, passed some of the most statocratic, interfering laws we have in this country, including forcing parents almost into a position of criminal culpability if their kids left high school at 18. Jerry Kennedy's going to lead, is the alternative, that kind of statocratic socialist engineering. Bob Rae? Yeah, Bob Rae can legitimately say, I've got the machine, because his brother John is the executive assistant the head of Power Corp, who, of course, was behind Krakia and Martin. But what is he for? We know what he's against. He's against his own record as premier.
That's the question we're having here. The question they're having in there is a very different question, because really, you and I aren't voting for these guys. 5,000 delegates who have paid an awful lot of money to come here and choose the next leader of the party are making the decision. And for a lot of them, and let's you know, flip against our own arguments. For a lot of them, these are bogus questions. Liberalism isn't about ideology. Liberalism is about a centrist, issue-by-issue, pragmatic, brokerage kind of politics, and that it's worked well for the country. So if you're supporting Bob Rae or Gerard Kennedy, you should say back at us, well, it doesn't really matter where they are on this issue or on that issue. What I want to know is, can they be trusted to lead the party and the country when whatever comes up, making sensible decisions? And that's what those 5,000 delegates are going to decide. And it's their decision, not ours.
John Ibbotson, we'll be right back with you. Short break after this. And *940 for Rogers cell users, #940 for Bell cell users. Do you care about the Liberal Party leadership? Does it really matter to you? And is there any hope for this party? And you can call after I finish talking with our guest, because I am... I don't get to talk to John Ibbotson on air that frequently, because our schedules don't mesh very well since the show went to daily at 7 o'clock. So, John, I'm exploiting you tonight.
Yeah, that's okay.
You said before the break the 5,000 Liberals or 2,000 have come into town so far. And remind me to get back to that, because I want to ask you about the delegate size. They're going to be choosing the leader. Okay. Day after the convention, you are Canada. John Ibbotson is Canada. What do you ask the leader? Why do we vote for the Liberal Party?
Well, I guess you want to ask what it is he's going to put forward as a platform, as a vision, as a strategy. Because the first thing the leader is going to do is react to the Tory budget. I mean, that's going to come down in early February. That's the first substantive piece of information that we're going to be getting from the Conservatives, and it's probably going to be a budget geared for an election. Now, I'm not saying there's going to be an election next spring.
Right.
I don't think it's going to happen until the fall, but it's going to be the document on which they run. So if the Liberal just stands up and says, well, there's not enough for this, and there's too much for that, and you forgot about this, and what about these other people, then I think, yeah, voters have a right. Canada has a right to shrug and say, we're not voting against anyone in this election. We voted against someone in the last election. This election we're going to vote for a particular vision of Canada, and what's yours. And he doesn't have a lot of time, and it will be a he, because Martha Hall Finley isn't going to take it.
Right.
He's going to have to be able to come up, I would contend, with an alternative plan for the country for those who don't believe that the Conservative plan is the one that is the one that they want for themselves.
You anticipated my next question. Not for nothing do I call you one of the finest minds in this country. Do you find, you, as an observer in Ottawa, that whether you agreed with the Tories or not, in opposition, they proposed as much as they opposed, while the Liberals opposed for the sake of opposing? And is that tactical mentality going to be a hurdle for any Liberal leader to get around? The Liberal notion of opposition for the sake of opposition?
Well, in the defense of the Liberals, though it's not my job to defend Liberals or Conservatives, in their defense, they're in sort of the same position that Stephen Harper was in back in 2004. He didn't have that much to offer in the election campaign because he had just been made Conservative leader and the Liberals had dropped the writ and he had to scramble to put something together. So it is reasonable to propose the following scenario. The Liberals pick a leader. They go into the next election, and once again we have a minority, and once again it's a Conservative minority because the Liberals haven't yet got their act together and offered us anything that would be compelling. So then the question becomes, Which leader do we pick, Liberal delegates, this weekend? Do we pick a leader who we think has a shot at beating Stephen Harper just because, you know, vote for Stephen, vote for me, I'm not Stephen Harper, even right. though I can't tell you what it's about? Or do we vote for a leader who may not be able to take it next time, but who can then start to work at rebuilding the party, making connections with Alberta, making the Liberals relevant in the West again, making the Liberals relevant in Quebec outside of English-speaking Montreal again, making Liberal vision relevant in Ontario outside of the city of Toronto, the city of Ottawa? These are compelling questions, because you might find that, that one of these guys has a better shot at winning, even though the odds are against him this spring or this fall. But you might also say that another leader is better at rebuilding the party for the shot that you're going to have in 2009-2010. If I were a Liberal delegate, that's the question I'd be asking myself.
Let's flip the question over now onto the Canadian electorate. Many people have said the Canadian electorate has been immune from being able to even discern what to vote for, that the elections are lost more than won because Canadians can't make up their minds what they're about. You agree with that?
No, I don't. I believe the Canadian electorate is very wise. I have never seen the result of a federal election that I did not think was a wise result. There isn't a Canadian vote, because absolutely, Quebecers vote differently from Albertans. They have different priorities. The makeup of the parliament reflects the split, the fissures within the country. But the country does a pretty good job of reflecting in its parliament those fissures and those splits, and to the extent that there can be a common consensus in picking a government that can govern by with that consensus. You take, example, the last election. The Conservatives did surprisingly well in parts of Quebec. They, of course, did well in their base. They made some inroads, but not enough for a majority government. No one is ready in this country yet to trust anyone with 4 years of unfamiliar power. I don't know when the next time is going to come that we do get a majority government. We may need to be. In fact, I would predict, if we have another minority government, that one of the major questions in this country is, what kind of a governing system do we want if we can never have majorities? Do we need to move to PR or something like that?
And that may not be a bad thing.
It may not be a bad thing, but it's going to be a thing, because the Conservatives are not getting everything done that they want to get done. And whoever wins the next election is not going to get that much done either, because minority governments can make things very difficult for you. Do we want to carry on that way with sort of one-third of everything we promise gets to happen and two-thirds of it gets voted down by Parliament? Or do we want to go back to a system either through coalition governments and PR or through electing a majority government under the old system where we give the government a blank check?
Well, it's going to be an interesting time. John Ibbotson, many, many thanks for taking the time to be with us tonight. I'm really happy we finally got this done.
My pleasure, Beryl.
Take care. Montreal will be right back after the news. Well, we've spent the first half hour talking about whether or not anybody out there cares who the new Liberal Party leader is, and whether the Liberal Party has anything to say about liberalism to this country, which is, as a philosophy, is important, but sorely compromised by this party. And I'll have more to say on that later in the hour. And it's interesting that today's Luciani Acura question of the day is, do you consider yourself Quebecois? Yes, you do. I think everyone who lives in Quebec is Quebecois. Or no, I may be a Quebecer, but I'm not Quebecois. If you want to vote on the question, go to 940montreal.com. And it's right on your left-hand side. We're going to talk in this half hour, though, about something that has a vision and has a distinct, coherent message to us. If John Ibbotson, as he clearly said over and over again, challenges the Liberal Party to make itself relevant on one broad set of issues, this government of Stephen Harper has not only made Canada relevant on the world stage and effective, but it's given us a vision and a pride and a purpose that we have been sorely missing. And that's a commitment for this country to restore its history of engagement in mankind's struggles for redemptive change. On the diplomatic front, he's been successful at La Francophonie and at the UN. On the military front, we've had tremendous successes. And last night's guest was Lieutenant General Michel Gauthier, who's in command of all Canadian foreign operations. The question is, the word isn't getting out. And our next guest is John Turley Ewart, comment editor for the National Post, who today addressed the very issue that, of course, General Gauthier could not address, which is why the message is not getting out. We're winning in Afghanistan, says John Turley Ewart, and we're not knowing about it. John, welcome to the show tonight. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to be on with you.
The pleasure is always mine. You know, you were making points in your column just on the facts. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had this rhetorical question out there in this ongoing debate with Jack Layton ever since he said he wants to talk to the Taliban. And I said, okay, Jack, what do you want to talk to them about, whether they shoot you as a socialist or cut your head off as a trade unionist? But the facts on the ground that you so well brought up, the GDP growth in the legitimate economy of Afghanistan that was 29% in 2002, It's growing by leaps and bounds today. Medical facilities, 661 basic health centers, 413 medical community centers, 66 district hospitals. We brought up last night the fact that over 70% of Afghani girls are going to school with no fear of having acid thrown in their faces. That over 95% of the country has been inoculated against diseases. As you mentioned again in your article, more than 4,000 kilometers of highway projects. Militarily, Operation Medusa was the most successful Canadian operation since Operation Apollo, where Canada was central communications command and control in the Gulf. And Richard Gimblett, who's an advisor to the Institute and was a Navy commander, went to the Dalhousie School of Foreign Policy Studies, now head of communications for the Navy, was so frustrated by that message about Apollo not getting out, of which General Gauthier was commander, that he wrote the book Operation Apollo. Mm-hmm. Why are we so reticent in this country to celebrate our own heroism?
Frankly, I don't understand it. I don't understand it because...
I should say, as I've often said on the program, if it wasn't for the National Post, I don't know if Canada would be bearable. It may be the last storehouse of reason and sanity as a newspaper. Mm-hmm. So it's not the Post's fault, but the dissemination problem exists.
I'm not going to blame the media, because the media is there to tell the story of, you know, when soldiers are killed, that is a story. And the Taliban know that. The Taliban know how to manipulate the media. They know that it's going to be a story when we blow up a vehicle and kill some NATO soldiers. But the question is why is Canada and also NATO, which is in control of this mission, handing over the media campaign to the Taliban? I mean, it is absolutely outrageous that we're making all this progress in Afghanistan, and yet nearly 60% of Canadians think our soldiers are dying for no reason. And the political lead within the Liberal Party wants to back away from this mission. I have to ask them, whatever happened to responsibility to protect? Because this is a mission that we can win.
Let's explain to our listeners what that is, because we went into it yesterday. But they're gesticulating madly at me, John. And we got to just pay a bill very briefly, so we'll
no
be
problem.
Right back. And we're very happy to have with us John Turley Ewart, comment editor of the National Post, and we're talking about why the message isn't getting out about we're winning in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And John, I'm sorry to interrupt you before the break, but you were just talking about how surprised you were that the Liberals aren't supporting the responsibility to protect. And I just wanted to, again, talk to our listeners about this, because I've mentioned it before, I mentioned it last night. If there's anything that came out of a century of blood in the past 100 years of war, first came the Nuremberg Principles, not the trials, the principles, that in 1947... said, and it was signed on by every civilized nation, we cannot stand by when tyranny and tyrants destroy their own people. Several years ago, the Canadian government was one of the main sponsors of the International Commission on State Sovereignty and Intervention that came up with a new doctrine in the international legal order called the responsibility to protect, preemptive intervention. Everybody embraced it. Nobody acted on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, and the thing is the Liberal Party championed this all through the 90s, and with Paul Martin. And then you have, for example, on Thursday, Bob Rae standing up in the Liberal caucus and saying we have to change the mission. Stephane Dion saying the same thing. You have Gerard Kennedy saying, you know, he wants our troops out. I mean, the problem, I think, is that they reflect in a more general sense that the message is not getting out that we're winning, that this is something that where we are actually putting into practice responsibility to protect. We're getting, girls in schools. We're getting medical care to people who need it in Afghanistan, and Canadians don't know this. Why is it happening? Well, it's happening because NATO doesn't think it's their job to do media, to tell their story, and the Canadian government doesn't feel it's their job to tell the story. And my question is, why not?
And this is a question we discussed last night. In the United States, it was a question I put to General Gauthier, and of course he couldn't answer it, but you and I can go at this. In the United States, there's obviously political ramifications for military leaders when they go before the press. But they go carefully, and they choose their words. They're not hesitant about it.
Right.
In Canada, however, The chief of defense staff, the top generals, feel that it is the responsibility of the political leadership to get the message out. In fact, they're under orders on that. Whose responsibility should it be? Should it be the political arm, or should Canada's military have a PR arm like the American military has?
No, I would say it's a political arm. I would say that our prime minister has a responsibility to make sure this story is told. He has a duty to explain to Canadians why their fellow citizens are dying in Afghanistan. And, you know, the thing is I just cannot comprehend why this is not occurring, because we are making so much progress. It doesn't take a lot of research. I mean, I was off in Washington and Brussels and down in Norfolk, Virginia, and talking to soldiers and to civilians who are involved in this and people from NGOs. This is not difficult. It should be told. And our government should be telling Canadians why our soldiers are dying, but they're not. And NATO, which is in command of this entire mission and is in a position to know exactly what's going on the ground, is in even better position to tell this story. You know, the way this story could be told is simple. I mean, you go to the media through the television ads, through newspaper ads, and you tell the simple story through the voice of the Afghani people who have benefited from this.
Could part of the reason be that despite the Prime Minister's remarkable ability to stand up on points of conscience, stand up to China, stand up to Islamic violence, say that we don't cut and run, is part of the problem, however, that he's aware that our national culture has such ungracious self-absorption, such a need for instant gratification, that he's almost cautious as a minority government to say to people, you know what, we don't have an end date for this mission, because this isn't about body counts and winning. This is about helping create a nation. And we'll be there nation building with the other 50 countries in the coalition for as long as it takes, because it's a new kind of war. Is it possible that Canadians aren't mature enough to accept that message?
Well, I think a lot of Canadians don't want to hear the message that our soldiers are out there shooting bad guys. And that's what we need to do to make Afghanistan safe.
God, John, are you and I allowed to talk like that in Canadian media? That there's actually good and evil, and it's not all gray, and there's not the right to be wrong?
Well, you know, there is an awful lot of Canadians out there who simply don't understand that there are people who don't care about debating issues or what you think or what you have to say. And I'm talking about the Taliban here in Afghanistan. They're interested in regaining power. That's their objective.
At any cost, and forgetting that the Kandahar mission, the reason we got Kandahar was because Martin dithered so long that there was only one mission left, and it was either leave the coalition or take Kandahar.
Well, this is it. And Canada has now got a voice at the table that it hasn't had for a generation. People in NATO listen to Canada. Canada's important. Now, the polling numbers I've seen suggest to me that most Canadians actually don't care that Canada's got a voice at the table, which I think speaks to a broader malaise within our understanding of where we are in the world.
Canadians can't seem to get the message that social justice doesn't stop at our borders, and if we don't care about what's happening abroad, if it's only about our little plot of land and our house and I'm all right, Jack, everything's going to wither at home, and we're going to submit to what we've been submitting. Massive statocratic engineering just to avoid any government oversight and to get a $20 extra in a government check for our favorite pastime.
Exactly, and this is not what Canada was about. I mean, Canada was involved in the Boer War, the First World War, the Second World War, the Korean War, the Cold War. We took positions and we stood up for principles.
With double the number of Canadians in uniform as a proportion of population than America had. We had 7%, they had 3%.
Exactly. And we were not afraid to fight. But the problem is the numbers I'm seeing in these polls suggest that Canadians, don't know what they're fighting for. And the result of that is you have Liberals and Jack Layton and other people trying to score political points by, dumping on our military, saying it's time to get out and we're not doing enough development.
Well, John Turley, you were commentator of the National Post. As long as you're around, as long as papers like yours are around, and as long as you guys like you and I can talk about it, even if there's a playwright out there writing a new enemy of the people, a la Henrik Ibsen, what was Emerson's quote? One person resolute, abiding by the truth, shall rally a majority. The majority shall be rallied. John Turley Ewart, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
Good night.
Montreal, we'll be right back. We try in this program to elucidate and elevate, not merely offer diversion. There's a common thread running between John Ibbotson's comments that the Liberal Party has to find a raison d'etre. What John Turley Ewart said about Canadians not having the sense of importance of their own individual consequence and quickly losing courage. And a lot of that has to do with small L liberal renewal. And small L liberal renewal will not get done in the next 3 days in this convention. But we must, as Canadians, think about it. Because industrial liberalism as we know it, both in its political and philosophical context, arose out of the aspirations of the newly emerging and newly enfranchised middle classes and working classes of the industrial revolutions of the mid-19th centuries. These new classes served the needs of both the teeming agrarian masses flooding urban centers to work the new engines of industry, as well as the entrenched moneyed classes who financed these engines but did not or could not direct them. For the former, the small merchants of the middle class provided the necessities of adapting to life in the new Leviathan. For the latter, the new managers of this class provided the expertise to keep it moving. The economic and political clout of this new class grew rapidly, as did its frustrations. Its members kept hitting a ceiling that was not so much glass as brick, and as the wealthy grew wealthier and the privileged more powerful. Through the effects of this new class, they refused to surrender any political or economic imperatives in return. An explosion was bound to come, and come it did. Across Europe, stormy and bloody confrontation marks the years from 1848 to 1858. These mini-revolutions failed, but their legacies created the hallmark of a new political agenda. Much as FDR forged the New Deal to drag the vested interests of his time toward reforms that would protect and stabilize a free but failed political economy teetering on the brink, so the vested interests of the 19th century came to accept the necessity of recognizing this new political agenda reflective of the aspirations of new classes that were not only professional, but political as well. It knew the secrets of the upper classes and maintained the fidelity of the working classes. It helped to adapt for the many who, despite just grievances, felt the radical philosophies that were sweeping the world at the time too constricting and confining. The goals of industrial liberalism fit like a well-made suit. It was a philosophy of liberation from the economic domination of the moneyed elites represented by large-C conservatism, without replacing it with the philosophy of dictatorial fiats from the arrogant social engineers represented by socialism. Liberalism was the political manifestation of the transcendent yearning for redemptive change in which the liberty of each citizen would be constrained only by the demands of equal liberty. Equal, not parity. Equal liberty for another. As I said at the beginning of the show, no less a radical than Winston Churchill encapsulated the core of the priorities of liberalism, serving as Minister of Social Welfare in the Liberal Asquith government in 1911 in Britain, to raise people up from poverty, to reconcile private interests with public rights, to attack monopoly, to reward enterprise but not with untrammeled privilege and preference, to exalt the individual over ruler or regulation, to expand freedom at home and abroad. This is our liberalism. This is our signature of our society. Nothing more, nothing less. No one has said it so well since, but those words held as the keystone for liberal thought for every liberal party in the Western world for several generations. But something happened to the liberals in Canada over the past 20 years. Instead of remaining loyal to the principles of political inclusion, the legal traditions of the equity of just consideration, the expansion of economic opportunity, they chose the politics of division and exclusion. They chose to make of law a two-edged sword of craft and oppression, and hungrily became the subventors of corporate welfare and cheap pork barrel vote-grabbing schemes to the point where it reached almost one-third of our federal budget over the past 13 years. They got so caught up with power for power's sake that they nearly destroyed the very fabric of society. To balance off the money they were spending to get corporate financial support and the votes of any special interest group that made any degree of noise, they imposed massive tax burden on the backs of the working men and women in this country. In their typical connivance, they tried to bamboozle Canadians by implementing politically correct nanny state programs that intrude into every aspect of our lives. They kept saying it was for own good. They knew how to run our personal lives better than we did. In truth, it was nothing more than fodder for flyers for the next election. As Tacitus said about Gaul, so the federal liberals have done to Canada. They have made a desert and called it peace. And it is from that ruin of a desert that this party must rediscover its soul. For if it does not, it will disappear and sadly take a lot of Canadian consequence with it. Nick Mays in Master Control, thank you very much. Montreal, Canada, we'll be back with you tomorrow night.